Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers episode number 67, Optical Gravity with Matthew R. Edwards of the University of Toronto. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/67. Show notes include the paper we read for this podcast, other papers we discussed in this podcast, and related episodes of Physics Frontiers. My name is Jim, and here is my conversation with Matt Edwards.
Hey, how's it going, Matt?
All right, Jim.
So one of my listeners actually brought this to my attention. I think I'd seen this paper go through one of my feeds somewhere, but one of my listeners emailed me and asked me if I could get in touch with you to talk about this.
Super.
And so, yeah, that's what we want to do. We want to talk about your paper, Optical Gravity in a Graviton Spacetime. And I think that came out in June.
Actually, back in March.
In March.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I thought when I looked at the Optic website, it said it was June 2022.
Oh, might be their issue number.
But you put it up on the archive in March?
I'm not sure. Could have been May. I can't remember.
Okay. But a couple of months ago. And so this is, you know, hot off the presses and all that stuff. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that to begin with. And I think probably a good place is, you know, this is physics. We're asking questions to elucidate what's going on in the world. And so I think maybe starting with what are the problems you're trying to solve?
Okay. I'm basically trying to solve like a whole lot of problems, but going at it in a kind of a slow way. So I've been working in this area of gravity for like 20 odd years now. Initially, I was drawn into the area for reasons partly related to cosmology, actually disagreement with the way cosmology was being portrayed. And I sort of wandered into gravity research and a particular model of gravity called the Lesage's theory, which is an old theory from practically Newton's time, a little bit later than that. But it's a simple mechanical model. Space is filled with tiny particles or waves that hit masses from each side, causing them to be pushed together due to the shading effect. That's a theory that was popular in the late 1800s. People like Kelvin wrote on it and others. Maxwell criticized it. But it fell out of fashion pretty much as soon as Einstein got involved. But there's still proponents of that theory going on to the present day, me being one of them. And in 2002, I edited this book called Pushing Gravity and had a lot of different variations, some older, some modern day forms of that theory presented. So it's 20-year anniversary of Pushing Gravity, actually. Now, time passed and I started to delve into some other aspects of gravity research and sort of became involved in some geological puzzles. One of the theories of gravity that you're probably aware of, Jim, is the Dirac's theory of the changing gravitational constant. And that idea posed some problems and had some implications also for geology, as was raised by Pascual Jordan, who wrote a book on this, actually. If the gravitational constant was decreasing, it could lead to a slow expansion of the Earth. So I found that kind of interesting. And there were problems with that, as say, if the gravitational constant was decreasing in that way, or even if the universe is expanding, there's problems with conservation of energy. Where is all that photon energy going? Where's all that gravitational energy going? So anyways, while looking at these theories of gravity and how they might relate to geophysics, and specifically the expanding Earth model, I noticed that if you simply take the expression for an object's internal gravitational potential energy, like for in the Earth's case, g times square of its mass divided by the radius of the Earth, and you multiply this by the Hubble constant, that this generates an amount of energy that was more than enough to possibly cause a slow expansion of the Earth, actually much more than what was needed. I thought this was sort of interesting. And then I looked around at the other planets in the solar system, and it seemed to be in each case that you could take this expression for the object's internal gravitational potential energy and multiply it by the Hubble constant, and it leads to a release of energy that's visible in part in their temperatures of these objects, as we see from space. And going to a higher level, that if you look at the whole universe's gravitational potential energy, all of it, there's a vast amount of energy created there. And I quickly got onto the idea that it's this decay of the universe's gravitational potential energy that's giving rise to gravity. It's basically, most of this energy is with like a body, like for us here, sitting here, most of the gravitational potential energy you have is with the most very distant stars in the visible universe. So all that energy, if it's slowly being decaying according to the Hubble constant, that is the basic mechanism of gravity, in that this energy can push objects together. Initially, I was seeing this in my sort of Lesage gravity mode. Now, going further with this, how is this actually happen? What is the real deal here? I could only imagine that this could be happening if you have, between any two masses, there's an energy flow between them that corresponds to the gravitational potential energy between these two masses. This sort of leads to the idea that I visualize it as a filament of energy interconnecting any two masses. All the masses in the universe are connected by these filaments of energy, and it's quite natural to refer to these as gravitons, the graviton exchange between masses. That graviton energy is the same magnitude as the gravitational potential energy between those masses.
I would like just to have an idea about what's going on with the gravitons. So when I was reading your paper, I had the feeling that this was flow of gravitons between the two objects.
Yes.
There are a lot of ways to think about what even a graviton itself is. And so what I wanted to ask you about that before we really got into what's going on with the filament model is what are these gravitons that are making up this flow, that are making up these filaments? And how do you actually look at what they are?
Well, the way that I look at them, Jim, is because these gravitons are decaying into photons in my model, the proper way to view these gravitons is as some kind of virtual photon. Now, Arto Enola has these filaments, a similar model of optical filaments joining masses. And what he's got as gravitons as being pairs of photons arranged together in a filamentary fashion between objects. And when they're paired, they are effectively neutral objects. But when they get out of phase with each other, then they reveal their photon character. And I've seen more models referring to this double paired photon model of gravitons. It attracts me a lot. And I think that's, I'm not at this point absolutely committed to a particular model of a graviton. I'm looking at it a little bit more generally, but I think it's something like that.
And a second question I had, this less from reading your paper and more from what you just said. I'd just like to understand, what do you look at as sort of your background space-time? What are you looking at that as? Are you looking at that as a flat background with gravity on top of that? Or are you looking at the filaments as space-time themselves?
I'm looking at the filaments as space-time themselves. This leads to a lot of simplifications in looking at the whole thing. There is certain aspects of general relativity that are carried over in this idea of these optical filaments joining all masses. Wherever there is a mass, the optical filaments converge on that mass. There's a greater density of them there. And that sort of is compatible with the idea of a curvature around masses. It turns out that this idea that space-time is no more than gravitons, which, as the way we've talked about it just a moment ago, some form of virtual photons, that helps also in certain problems related to cosmology. For example, it's considered a proof of the Big Bang model that the time dilation that we've seen in supernova at distances is considered to be a proof. But it's not really, if you look at it from the standpoint of space-time itself is a physical substance made of these gravitons hyphen virtual photons, because then you have a situation where as any packet of space-time expands and you got photons within that packet, it will lead to the same result of a time dilation effect. It's, in other words, space-time is expanding. It's expanding because gravitons themselves are also being redshifted. Well, we haven't talked about the redshift yet, but gravitons themselves are redshifted. This leads to this thing of space-time being expanding. We can touch on this later. There are a lot of different moving parts here.
Very good. I just really wanted to make sure that we knew what we were talking about with a couple of these very basic things before you started talking about the filament model in a little more detail. We had just started talking about the filament model, I think. Was there anything more you wanted to add to that?
Okay, well, on the filament model, okay. So we want to get back to what's causing gravity. So the filament model, just think of it as really like optical fibers connecting all the masses in the universe, and visualize this now. It's an optical medium in its own right. Now, this gets back then to the optical mechanical analogy in general relativity. It goes back to even Einstein, Eddington, people like that realized that relativistic light deflection around a star is akin mathematically to just refraction through a medium around the object with a varying density gradient. So if we have, and we look at these optical fibers, well, that's our medium. That is our optical material here. Well, how then can we explain gravity from that? And the answer which I'm putting forward is this. It relates to a controversy in physics termed the Abraham-Minkowski controversy. It relates to how optical momentum changes within a transparent material. And basically, if a photon moves through a transparent material according to the Abraham interpretation, then it's leads to a situation where that block of transparent material is set in motion during the time that a photon is inside it. It goes back to a thought experiment back in the 50s by a fellow named Balazs, and this still forms the basis for the modern interpretations of Abraham momentum. Although that's a very complex topic in its own right, I view the universe as one big block of optical material. And if the photon moving through this huge block, which can actually slice down into the little sections as it passes each star, but we can also look at it as a whole block, it's losing its momentum during that whole passage of time through that block of cosmic optical material, which are our gravitons. And if you just take the relationship, all photons basically gone by the double time, right? So that gives you the idea of what is the rate at which photon momentum is being lost to the cosmos. And then I did some calculations in this paper and actually in an earlier paper that showed that if you just calculate the refractive index of the cosmos as a whole in this way, it does generate the Hubble constant. So from that, it gets the amount of momentum that's lost. Because remember, because of this Hubble force that I was talking about earlier, we have this energy being generated from all points in space, from the most distant parts of the universe, converging on like two local masses. And it's not impinging on them directly. So that's basically the mechanism of gravity that I'm proposing. It's another aspect to it that relates again to space-time. Basically, in looking at this picture of mine, particles all behave as though they are processing space-time. So you've got space-time degenerating from the remote parts of space. And so you've got these photon energies appearing locally within this graviton context. But when these arrive finally at particle centers, they are reconverted back into these gravitons, these pure gravitons that are in that particle pair model. They're totally overlapping. And that means that what we really have is space-time itself is being recycled. It's degenerating due to the Hubble redshift. Space-time itself is degenerating, but it is refurbished when it gets to masses, and masses take all this energy and reprocess it, and it goes out in nice coherent graviton waves within these filaments.
So now what I understood with the processing of space-time, you were saying that, at least in the paper, you know, that objects are moving around, basically the field is changing in response to how things are going around. And in general relativity, people don't usually do that, but that's just because calculations with two large objects get really hairy, right? So normally you're using a test particle when you're talking about things like that. You're saying, I'm going to have an Earth, yeah, put a little satellite right out there, and we'll just pretend the satellite doesn't do anything.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of like to keep it with two particles because it always keeps in mind that gravitational potential energy is always between two bodies, and it's these real physical connections. And if they start to talk about potentials, it's like you kind of fall astray there. Anyways, I don't know if I'm replying properly to your point or not.
That's just what I saw though. I guess one other thing that I'd like to mention is that this Abraham Minkowski or Minkowski Abraham controversy has been going on a while. You did have a really nice reference in there from David Griffiths, I think, which is a resource letter. I'm going to put those in the show notes for people as well as your thing.
You might want to put Mansoor Apur in there as well. He's one of the big guys on that.
Okay, that's 23 in your paper. I mean, that's really interesting, that particular controversy having one of them saying the momentum in the material is proportional to the index of refraction. The other is inversely proportional.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, I mean, they couldn't be more different.
Yeah. Right? And it's amazing that how much this is still discussed. It's like new papers every year. It's one of these things that are they ever going to get to the bottom of it? You just don't know.
So I think people should really look into that as well. I mean, that I think people would enjoy that as well.
Jim, can I interrupt just for a moment? Part one, people are going to say with that Abraham interpretation and this moving through the transparent block, a photon losing momentum and all that. In the Balazs thought experiment and in what Mansoor Apur says, as it leaves the block, a photon will return to its normal speed and the block will be actually brought to a stop. And that part of it is different from what I'm saying, because actually the block, if you think in a cosmological sense, there is no edge to the block, either at the front edge or the back edge. It's we're all in this block all the time. So it leads to a slightly different kind of interpretation. I'm just pointing that out for completeness.
Okay. I want to make sure that it's clear. I mean, you're talking about this cosmic medium, but when you're talking about that cosmic medium, you're talking about that network of graviton filaments.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, we're not talking about some third thing.
No. There is no third thing. Forget about the zero-point fields, all these other things, because let's put it straight, Jim. We've got enough energy in space-time itself, when you define it in this way, as gravitons, to cause gravity. And that's the main objective. I haven't advanced the theory enough to explain the other forces. That's something to strive for, of course. But we don't need those other energies. I don't see how or why they would even exist when you put it the way that I have.
Excellent. So I think that's more or less the first part. You think you'd be comfortable starting to talk a little bit about the intellectual history?
Yeah, we can go at it a little bit. Why don't you ask it to me, like the how you would like to go back to that point, to that, I guess, starting with Eddington.
We could start with Eddington. Why don't we just give a little summary about where I think we are, and then we can go forward.
Okay, sure.
We don't have that much left in here, really, to be honest, but you never know. It could end up being another 70 minutes, because, I mean, it just looks small on the page, right?
Okay,
so. So you never really know. I think here we've gotten a pretty good look at your model, right?
Uh-huh.
This model of graviton filaments connecting different objects in space-time. I'd like to know how this relates to previous theories. You said there were other optical or maybe optico-mechanical theories of gravity earlier.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of intellectual thread there. And I'd like to know how your theory relates to them. What from those things have you brought in and what sort of things maybe have you not kept?
I think one of the first theories was Wilson's theory in 1921, I think, and which was one that Dickey expanded on later. They go on to the idea of a polarizable vacuum. First off, they get rid of space-time curvature and they go to a flat Euclidean model and then use this idea that polarizability can occur within this vacuum. And that leads to gravitational forces. And I have to just say that I don't think that that doesn't appeal to me very much. I just don't see how you can have small polarization effects like that generating forces over like very long distances. It lacks precision. And that was a problem with general relativity. People use general relativity to try to explain gravity, you know, just through space-time curvature. And the mechanism is not clear, and it just really leads nowhere. Turning the matter over to theories of quantum gravity, which I would say that my theory is a theory of quantum gravity more than it is a theory of general relativity, but I'm trying to connect the two. And I say other theories of quantum gravity are, they've become too numerous to mention practically. If you look at theories of quantum gravity now, they look like an evolutionary tree of theories. There's just so many branches going on, and I don't really see how students even grapple with all this stuff. It is so unclear, all loaded with math. This goes for string theory as well. It's so far from trying to reach a simple model of the universe that it's appalling, really. honestly, Jim, I can't believe what the state of physics is. It's how students get through graduate work in this is beyond me. And I'm just trying to get to a simpler model. Even Dickey's paper, I find that like it's really loaded with stuff there. And I'm using some of these arguments as I'm going along. But I really sort of move over to a simpler picture that I've given.
Okay, so part of what you're doing is you're trying to envision something that's doing this at that lower level rather than, well, I mean, if you're talking about general relativity or possibly any other metric theory, you're just saying, I've got a description of how space-time will act, but I don't have any reason why it's actually doing that. Is that sort of the reason why you're trying to put together a theory on these lines?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understood your question. Whose space-time? Was that theirs or mine? I couldn't quite get.
Okay. So, well, I'm more or less trying to see if I'm understanding what you're saying about what you're taking and what you're leaving.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that you're trying to get a more, let's call it visceral idea about what's going on in gravity rather than just a mathematical representation.
Definitely.
Okay. So, and you've got this two-photon graviton.
Yes, that's one way of viewing that graviton.
Something with that. When I was talking about comparisons with other theories, one of the things I was thinking about was, and I'm not sure if this is really good. I was never really sure if this is very good for your particular theory. I was thinking about what's called the parameterized post-Newtonian framework, which is just a way to compare different theories of gravity, metric theories in particular. Yours is not really a metric theory, although at least one of your references is trying to put a metric on something similar. I don't think it's on the same thing you're doing, but it was fairly similar. I think it was Evans was doing that. I think it appeared in the American Journal of Physics.
Yes. Yes. James Evans is one of the front people on this optical mechanical theory of general relativity. And him and others like Rosenquist have done a lot to try to explain things like the orbits of objects around the sun using this sort of approach. They're trying to connect it ultimately to matter waves and that sort of thing. Evans also is interested in Georges-Louis Lesage's theory as well. He contributed to the Pushing Gravity book. I think he's got his own Lesage book out now or soon. Sorry, I got off on a tangent there.
That's perfect. That's exactly the kind of tangent we want. If you're going to have a tangent, that's where it is.
Okay.
Okay. So anyways, I mean, I was looking at that and I was kind of looking at, I don't have the page marked right now. I took out my notes and now I have
see.
No idea.
Okay.
I'm not going to flip around in a book for 3 minutes trying to find.
No worries. I just feel like I'm sitting halfway between the general relativity approach and the quantum gravity approach, somehow in the middle. I'm there and I'm not the best one to actually describe what that position is. You probably can do that way better. And thank you.
You obviously are giving a mechanism. The mechanism is gravitons, right? If you were to characterize it fully that way, quantum gravity would be a way to think about it. But I think usually if you're talking about quantum gravity, it has to go back to this Wheeler-DeWitt equation.
Right.
So it might be categorized as a third kind of theory altogether.
Probably.
I expect somebody who's actually in the field would probably characterize it differently than quantum gravity, but you know, they're not here, so they don't get a choice. So we have that. I would just like to talk a little bit about the cosmic microwave background and your theory. We have to talk about that redshift.
I forgot,
we didn't actually talk about the redshift. So why don't we talk about the redshift and then talk about what happens with the cosmic microwave background and the black hole information stuff.
We did cover in different sections here. Really, it's just as a photon or a graviton, a graviton being visualized as virtual photons or such, they are also being redshifted as they pass through the graviton space-time. It's a simple loss of momentum, actually loss of coherence. The gravitons are undergoing a conversion to photons in using that paired photon model. And that's really it. That is the mechanism. Pair that with the idea that these degraded gravitons and photons get reprocessed by masses into higher energy coherent photons and gravitons again. And that's basically what the cosmic background is too. But first off, have I answered your question about the redshift well enough?
Yeah, I think there was one other thing. So you're saying that photons are losing this momentum. But as I recall from reading your paper here, there wasn't like a net loss of momentum. The momentum was spreading off
into
other things. Could you describe that a little bit just to be clear?
Okay, so there's two cases here, like the photon and the graviton. And I should add that initially, like about 2014, I was using photons alone to try to explain gravity using really the same exact mechanism. But I realized that the cosmic microwave background is not enough energy in it to cause gravity the way that I was describing it. So gravitons do have it if you're defining them as being equal in energy to the gravitational potential energy of the universe. And so what's happening is, like, as gravitons are processed by a particle, let's say, they are spinning out from there in a coherent graviton, like new gravitons, new space-time, in other words, because space-time is being regenerated. So as it's going out from here, out into space, it's interacting with all these other filaments out there in space between all the other masses in the universe. And each time that it does that, losing some of its coherence and momentum is being transferred in the process to the other filaments that it's contacting along the way. And that's the basic gravity mechanism. The momentum is conserved in the process. But you see that, like, for example, it's easier to see with photons that as light travels from the distant parts of the universe getting to us, it gets redder and redder. Where did that energy all go? It went into the other filaments too that it interacted with along the way, forming smaller level, lower energy photons in those same filaments. And so all the energy that's siphoned off that way through the other filaments, that's all equals the energy that's lost from the original photon as it traveled through space. And so the same thing basically goes with gravitons.
Excellent. I think that's pretty good. I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that there wasn't any momentum just disappearing.
I totally subscribe to a universe that is in a continuous equilibrium. There's no energy being lost. The Big Bang model has this concept of it doesn't matter if energy disappears through expansion. Who's to say the universe has to do this or that? But I'm old-fashioned in that respect, and I just say, look, the universe is a stable entity. It's recycling all its processes. You can see this in star formation rates, star death rates. You can see this in the rate at which even stars burn their hydrogen supplies. It's all proportional to the Hubble constant. And so that's what I strive for. That's what my basic goal here is in physics and cosmology, is to try to describe this equilibrium universe and get away from this ridiculous Big Bang monstrosity that has dominated physics. And now introducing new things, dark energy, the dark matter, totally unnecessary things. That's what we're after here.
Excellent. So I think we've got everything that I really wanted to be clear on before we got into the cosmic microwave background.
Sure.
So could you explain what you're saying about the cosmic microwave background?
Okay,
I mean, you've mentioned it several times. Let's just get a real coherent idea about that.
As light is moving through space, the cosmic microwave background, it's basically energy that's from starlight. Okay. Basically, that's the main source of it initially. As photons go through space, starlight going through space, subject to the Hubble redshift for all the reasons that we've talked about so far, as it's going, it's producing these longer wavelength photons, extremely long wavelength photons. And these are energies below the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, lower than the 2.73 K. So you got all this bath of a really, really, really low energy photons. And that's all interacting with masses, charges in space. Gradually, it's that interaction between that long wave degraded radiation, the ions in space, that is reproducing this even what we call the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's you can think of it as, like, this gets to the question of you'll remember what Kelvin predicting that the universe was going to eventually cool off and die a heat death because of entropy and energy gradually dissipating to nothing. But we can get away from that in this way its lower energy photons are being reconverted back into the cosmic microwave photons.
Okay, so this is what you're getting from this graviton filament theory.
Yeah, that's how you would generate. And conversely, for the graviton part of that, it's ordinary space-time that's being regenerated. The photons are just like a small elements within the graviton filaments.
Excellent. I thought you had a really interesting discussion on what was going on here with the black hole information idea. So you had filaments on the inside and the outside of the black hole, as I recall. Mm-hmm. Could you just give a brief summary of that as well?
Sure, Jim. Like, I've actually done some work on this since the time of this paper here. And what I've discovered actually is that when we talk about black holes, and there's this idea that there's a singularity, and this is another area where physics has gone completely haywire. In my mind, it's out of control. Too many odd ideas put out there as though they are really serious ideas. In my model, if you look just as a black hole and these same kinds of filaments are connecting all the masses inside of a black hole, well, you've basically got the same total effect there as it's like a miniature universe as just a black hole. It's not a singular point at all. It is an extended object that's acting. At its scale, it is acting in the same way as the universe as a whole is operating. The difference is it has a different Hubble constant because it's turning over much more rapidly due to its small size. So I'm not too big actually on the thing of the information and all those paradoxes of the black holes, because I think these are sort of things that arose partly because of the faulty conceptualizations about black holes as being singularities in the first place. I'm working on a paper right now to flesh that out a bit about black holes. Basically, Jim, the inside of it, it's all the masses are connected. Like at the core of the black hole, it's really seeing just black hole filaments from other black hole particles. But right on the outer shell of it, you can see that those parts of the black hole's shell, they're interacting with both the external universe and the internal black hole, what I call universe. And so it's like their half of their mass is black hole mass, because we're using the Machian idea of where the mass originates. It's in these interactions with the distance. But half is with black hole mass, half of it's with the visible universe mass. They're living in both worlds. And so I think that this property could be partly to explain something that's not really talked about much now, but Arp's idea that why there was these high redshifts in quasars. He thought that it might be due to aging of matter, that because new matter is being formed, it has a lower mass in his model. And so that's what's giving it a high redshift. I don't think that's quite right. But what it could be, if those masses, those particles in the shell of a black hole, they got half their mass from the black hole, half their mass is originating from the distant universe, it's going to have a redshift already. To our eye in the visible universe, their mass looks like it's only half of what it really should be, according to MC squared. The other half is really connected in with a black hole. And to go one step further, I think that this could also possibly explain this idea of the accelerating universe, which is another bad idea, because everyone's used to thinking of the universe as expanding and there's a certain radius that it gets to. And all we know is that what we can see, what we call the visible universe. But beyond there, there's enough more matter, more stars, as much volume as in our visible universe. So those masses that are close to that halfway point, you could think of them as in the shell of our visible universe. Those masses in that shell, they're interacting with that other outside universe, outside our visible universe. So those masses, they don't have the right mass according to how we would observe them. And so I believe this could lead to the measurements that suggest that there's a universal acceleration, but which I think are just an error.
Excellent. It looks like, to me, there are a lot of things that you think are not being done very well in physics today and so forth. But I mean, it looks like you've got a really interesting way to put these things together here. Thank you very much. It was great having you on.
It really went well, I thought. And I thank you again.
Thanks again, Matt. I do have to go. It's kind of long now.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, episode number 67, Optical Gravity with Matthew R. Edwards of the University of Toronto. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/67. Show notes include Matt's paper that I read for this podcast, other papers we talked about, Matt's book, related episodes of Physics Frontiers, and a link to some random questions that I asked him and put up as an advertisement on YouTube. Thank you very much for listening. Bye now.